Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 5 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I'm your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Henhouse Studio in Nashville, Tennessee. I'd just like to thank everyone for tuning in and being an encouraging audience over the last few years, and I'm sure you will enjoy this season as well. We'll take some deep musical dives together in the coming months, and I'm looking forward to sharing some of these conversations I've been having with some incredible musicians and music producers with you. We have a couple of continuing sponsors that help to bring you each episode this season. The first is Union Tube and Transistor, making incredible guitar effect pedals out of Vancouver, BC. My old pal Chris Young at Union has been laying stuff on me for years, starting with his prototype Buzz Bomb pedal about 15 years ago. Since then, he's become a leading light in boutique pedal manufacturers with an extensive line of pedals like the Moore pedal, the Lab compressor, and the Sone Bender that are constants in my recording world. Check out their line of pedals at uniontone.com. And the second sponsor for the season is Black Mountain Thumb Picks. I've been using these myself for several months, and I think they're great. Cole McBride, the owner, is trying to make everybody happy and now has medium gauge, heavy gauge, jazz tipped, left-handed, and regular and extra tight spring tensions available. Check them out at blackmountainpicks.com. So even though I've been doing this podcast for about 5 years, my heart just isn't into hounding companies for advertising dollars. So as always, this show mostly relies on listener support to keep going. And thanks to everyone that has done that in the past, it's a huge help to know that there's people out there willing to kick in to make it all possible. So if you're interested in doing so, there's a few simple ways to help out. First of all, please just tell your music nerd pals about this show. Word of mouth is probably the best way to get the show heard more. If you're in a position to kick in a bit financially, you can make a one-time donation or join in on my Patreon account, which is a monthly donation billed directly to your credit card at any amount of your choice. You'll also get access through Patreon to some private videos and other stuff as I make it available. And the third way that you can help out is to buy a t-shirt or other swag as it comes available. You can have a look at those or make a donation or join the Patreon, all at the new website, which is www.makersandshakerspodcast.com. And please don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get them from. And while you're at it, folks, don't forget to have a listen to our offshoot show called One Life, featuring Jim Burns. It's a fun concept podcast involving live improvised music and off-the-cuff storytelling. I think you might dig it. And finally, please follow the show on social media. I have links to Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook all on the website, as well as a YouTube link. And that YouTube channel actually is going to get a bit more action this year. In the past, I've just put up links to some live performances, but I will be starting a video series this year about music and recording that I think you might dig. So please subscribe to my YouTube channel as well. Links are all at the top of the page at www.makersandshakerspodcast.com and at my personal website, which is stevedawson.ca. So that's about it for the biz side of things. Let's get going. On to this week's show. Well, hello, everybody. Thanks so much for tuning in. Steve Dawson here. This is episode 109 of the podcast. Thanks again for listening. My guest on the show today is the incredible producer and engineer, Mr. Matt Ross Spang. Before we get going here this month, I would just like to mention that we're up for a podcast award this year. And since that is a listener voted award, I would love for you to go over to their website and give us a vote. You just go to the Podcast Awards, which are podcastawards.com, and click on the blue box you will see right there to vote. And after you sign in, there's a bunch of categories and you can vote on any of the categories or any of the podcasts that you know and love. And you will find Music Makers and Soul Shakers in the music category. So head over there, check it out, give us a vote. Thanks. And I hope you're all doing well. I've been really busy. Things are starting to crank back up around these parts, which is awful nice. I've been doing these remote sessions all through COVID that I've mentioned here and there throughout the show. And we actually did a contest for young songwriters to enter their songs, and we were going to pick winners and record their music with them remotely. And that has now finished and is a complete project, and you can go and check out those youngsters. That's all up at thehenhousestudio.com, and you can click on the Henhouse Express, and that's our remote recording crew. And right at the top of that page is some information on the contest that we had for the kids. It's called Henhouse Express Junior, and they're great. It was so fun and cool to work with those kids, a couple from New York, a couple from Ontario, a couple from Saskatoon. So go have a listen. All right, Matt Rossbang, what a dude. This conversation was actually the first time that we'd ever spoken, but I've since doing this, I've worked with him on a project and know firsthand what a badass he is. Oh yeah. Matt grew up in Memphis and he spent his entire career there more or less. I mean, he travels and does things in other places, but basically he has set up shop in Memphis his whole career. He's embraced and enhanced the whole Memphis vibe like no one else. I'm not going to go into his history too much here because we talked through most of it in this interview. But the things that you need to know are that Matt started out basically interning at Sun Records in Memphis and working his way up to chief engineer there. So Sun Studios is the famous studio, of course, where Elvis and Johnny Cash and all that were recorded by Sam Phillips. And it's still a functioning studio and museum, and Matt was kind of in charge of that place. So he was the chief engineer there running the studio, and he was doing tours in there all day. So the tours would happen all day, and then they would shut that down around 6, and then the sessions would kick in. And he did that like day in and day out for about 10 years. And so after doing that, he started getting offers to work on outside projects like independently, and he took a leap into the world of freelancing, left his job at Sun and started working for other artists and producers, amassing a killer list of credits on records by Margo Price, Jason Isbell, and John Prine, and lots more. He then set up shop at Sam Phillips Recording, which is where I worked with him, and man, that place is incredible. It's where Sam Phillips went to when he outgrew Sun, and it's like a time capsule in there. Amazing rooms and echo chambers that are exactly how they were back in the day, sort of. Even the halls and offices are straight out of the 1960s. So he's been in there and has worked on some amazing stuff, including Al Green, and even getting to mix a bunch of cool Elvis Presley recordings that were unearthed. So yeah, he's got a ton of great credits and has done some amazing work. But what I love about this guy and the way that he operates is that he has an incredible understanding about vintage equipment and aesthetics, but he's not hung up on it like some people get with when they're really into like old school recording techniques. He is perfectly willing and happy to roll with modern stuff and modern equipment, but he's very dialed in to an old way of recording that I really relate to. He loves recording live. He loves to capture sounds with a minimal microphone setup rather than, you know, 12 mics on a drum kit. He'll use two, one microphone on a horn section or a group of singers. And he makes it sound modern and incredible. And he has some really cool techniques that are unlike anybody that I've ever seen or worked with. Now that I've worked with him, I've seen him do it as well. And I just find his whole vibe and sound and skill set to be very inspiring and inspired. And I think that his work is definitely worth investigating for that reason alone. So Matt's next phase, though, is going to be moving into very soon into an incredible new studio that he's built in Memphis in this huge warehouse that was a Sears distribution center. And it's been repurposed recently into all kinds of restaurants, studios, radio stations. There's a listening library, stuff like that. And it's called Crosstown. And I saw the studio nearing completion, and it's incredible. And we talk about it here, but that's what we're talking about when we mention Crosstown. It's this huge complex that his studio is a part of. So here we go, yakking about all this stuff. Please check out Matt's work if you don't know it already, and keep up with his whereabouts on Instagram, where he's very active as Monsieur Matt, and at his website, which is southerngrooves.com. All right, let's get down to it. Here is my conversation with Matt Ross Spang. Enjoy. I've always found it really interesting when recording folks really identify with a region and a sound, like a regional sound. And you seem to have really embraced the Memphis sounds. I mean, not that there's just one sound coming out of Memphis, but like a classic Memphis sound. Like you've really mastered the idea of it and kind of embraced. And I know that originally you're from Memphis, but I don't know much about, like, you know, whether you actually grew up there your whole life. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about, you know, growing up in that area, if that's where you're from, and just how you got into music in the first place and what Memphis meant to you as a youngster.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I was born and raised in Memphis, grew up here, and my parents had really great music taste growing up. So I was hearing a lot of Dylan and Van Morrison, and my dad was really into the alt country, like the beginnings of like Sun Volt and Wilco and Uncle Tupelo. And then, of course, we had all the Memphis music that, you know, is around. It's in the air, it follows you wherever you go. So even when we go out of town, I hear like Johnny Cash, Big River, or, you know, a whole lot of shaking going on. It's like everywhere, which is great. But music was always around, and I would, you know, I would make little cassette mixtapes and stuff, and bright CDs were coming out. I would buy a lot of CDs. It wasn't until I was like, I think I was about 11 when my folks visited some of my dad's family in Ohio, and one of the cousins had gotten a guitar, and I don't think he cared about it, but I just sat there, remember, in that back bedroom, and just like, I couldn't do anything on it. By no means was I a prodigy or anything close to that. But this thing was so cool. This guitar was so cool. I don't think he had an amp at the time. It was like a Telecaster ripoff. But when we got home, that was my big thing, is I wanted to learn guitar. So I started taking lessons from this guy. Funny enough, his name was Mike Love.
Really?
Yeah, and I think he could tell. He was a great teacher because he said, listen, we're not going to worry about, you need to learn how to tune it, obviously, but we're not going to worry about scales and stuff till you know if you really like it. So bring me like 20 songs you want to learn, and we'll slowly learn those. And then I think he kind of realized, like, I never really wanted to learn scales or anything, so we just go over songs and then kind of jam a little bit over the while. I forget how long I went with him, but
What kind of tunes were you learning? Like, what were you into when you were that age?
Well, you know, it's funny enough, like, I would bring him some things, and I remember he was like, let's hold off on this till you get some, like, skills, or, like, you know, build up some skills. So I remember, like, the James Bond theme would be, like, something we would work
That's
on.
That's badass guitar, man.
Kind of single note stuff, you know, and then it would evolve into, like, I remember Secret Agent Man. I guess there's a lot of spy stuff, because I remember we did Secret Agent Man too, but I think he was wanting me to learn simple melody things. I was never into like flashy guitar. I never wanted to learn how to do pull-offs or big solos. I've never been a Les Paul guy, so I think it was more of like simple things like that I really liked, and rhythmic things. And then that translated much later in the life too with session stuff. But I started really focused on guitar. Back then I was really into basketball, and then when guitar came along, basketball just went completely away. I think the minute I started like getting okay at guitar, I could no longer catch a ball. Like I definitely lost some sports ability.
Your mojo shifted.
I think it, well, I mean, I think innately it just went away. It was like, you can't, you're doing music, so you're going to be, I was never like great at basketball either, but I just really became bad, I think. And then I really just focused on guitar every night, and never saw it as like a career or anything. It just was like, I was obsessed with it. I'm sure you were the same way. You played till your fingers bleed, and you would get it picked up the next day. And that really consume me. And then when I was about 16, when I was 14, my parents bought me 2 hours of studio time at Sun Studio. And
thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, thanks, parents. And I had played with a bunch of guys in high school and stuff, but like we weren't in middle school, but like we weren't we never like were, we knew we weren't good enough to go like go play a gig somewhere, and that just didn't seem feasible. Like we just would jam and write up in the bedroom, you know, and play in the garage or whatever, and then we just want to get in the studio. That was the big goal. And so they, my cousins were the general managers and stuff of Sun. And so my parents booked the time through them. We got 2 hours with this guy, James Lott. He was incredible. He's one of the greatest guitar players I've ever known, but he wore a beret and he cussed like a sailor. He chain smoked, and I was 14. So that was incredible.
That's cool.
And he would smoke inside, you know, and he was like moving the faders, and he really treated us like we deserved to be there, and we absolutely didn't. And I really recorded a couple bad things that'll hopefully never be heard again. But I remember the guy I was with, he kind of fell asleep. Like he took a nap while he was mixing. Like he was not at all intrigued by that part, and I thought that was the coolest part, watching him with the big board and the effects and changing things and EQing things. And
so right away that was like you were drawn to
that, that was it, and that's like that. Yeah. then the guitar almost became like basketball, you know what I mean? It kind of went away, and he told me to come back and intern, and I couldn't drive obviously, so when I start at 16 I started working at Sun as a tour guide, because it's a museum during the day.
Yeah.
And there was an intern at that time, but he quickly got let go for, I forget what happened, but he was quickly gone. And then I got to start interning too. So the studio would start recording at 6 o'clock at night. But giving the tours was one of the best things ever, because I get out of high school, I go straight to Sun, and then you're giving a 45 minute hour long tour to tourists once every hour or so. And it got me really good about, you know, being comfortable in front of lots of people and entertaining them and making, you know, it's Sun is a interesting place. And that's also what I learned from James during sessions. You know, it's all these people's dreams to come record in this room.
Sure.
And they'll come from all over the world to come record there, and you got to make them feel at home and make them know that they're welcome, because they're so intimidated and stuff. And that has been a great lesson for any other studio, but really learning it there was a big—
That's interesting, because that is a big thing about production. The production side of things is like getting people comfortable in their environment and in a situation that wouldn't necessarily be comfortable at all.
Exactly. And also, like, so many people that would come to Sun, it was just their dream to come record. They may not have been super talented or you know, a lot of them even weren't even like really musicians. They just wanted to come record.
Sure.
That's Right Mama in Elvis's room or something. Sure. Or we'd even have like company retreat things, and, you know, making them feel at home, but then also they would always, you know, they always start by apologizing, like, I'm wasting your time, or, you know, this is not good enough for you, and making them know, no, this is what I love to do, and this is, I'm here for you, and you're not wasting my time. And that applies even now, because so many people worry that they're, you know, they're struggling to get a solo or something, that they're wasting your precious time, and no, we're here to create, so I'm here as long as you want.
So is that what it was a lot back then? Was like one-off, like just 3-hour sessions of people coming through, a lot of tourists wanting to record and stuff like that? Was that basically the gig at that point?
Man, it was everything. So yeah, you would do like I always remember that some of the funniest, weirdest ones would be right neck butted up to like a really cool one. Like I forget who it was, but like we had T-Bone Burnett came in with John Mellencamp, and they did 3 days with Jay Belarose and Mark Ribot, some of your previous pod people, and Dave Rowe, my good friend Dave Rowe.
Were there a lot of quirks with that room?
I mean, Sun is, that's another thing. I grew up in the studio of like another era, in the sense that studio is one room, no baffles. I later built a baffle or two, no isolation. You know, when I first started there, we had like early bad digital equipment and an old analog Soundcraft board. And then as I became the head engineer, I slowly made it more period correct, while also having a modern Pro Tools rig and some stuff, because not everyone wants to sound like 1951 in there, which I'm totally fine with. I want to be able to do anything. You know, you can only put so many microphones in there. Your vocal microphone is your snare reverb microphone.
Is there an echo chamber in that
There's no actual real echo chamber, but Sam Phillips used the front office kind of as a chamber on, you can hear it on Driving Slow, Johnny London. It was a saxophone. It's actually the first record released on Sun. They did all live to mono, like kind of Alan Lomax style.
Yeah.
And then I think, like, you know, the next, after those 3 days, I had like a Elvis impersonator from Denmark or something who couldn't speak a lick of English.
Learned to speak phonetically by listening to Elvis.
Yeah, but you know, so you get all these random people, then you get these great musicians and these not great musicians, and you get these well-known people and these not well-known people. Mm-hmm. It was such a thing, but it was really amazing that, like I said, because you're making their dreams come true, and it doesn't matter who they are. Like you're never too good to make that happen for somebody or to help facilitate that. So it was.
Right.
I loved every day, even when the person, you know, was doing something wild. They all treated the building with respect and me and I get right back to them. So it was. It really didn't matter to me. And to make it's easy to make, you know, Chris Isaak or some of these guys who record their sound good because they already sound good. So you just, you can put a mic on them and just stay out of the way. And then some of these folks, you had to work really hard to figure out where to move the microphone or adjust stuff for it would be more pleasing. And that was really helpful too. I would use that front room. It had like a great drum room sound, like just leave the door open and put a mic up. You'd also pick up all the motorcycles going by.
Right, Wednesday, yeah. That's a busy
Wednesday
street.
Nights. Wednesday nights in Memphis in the summer is bike night on Beale Street, so you'd have just insane. You can actually hear it on a Margot Price song on Midwest Farmer's Daughter. I think it's I'll have to look at the song title, I could tell you, but there's a motorcycle when we just left it on the recording
because
it went through the front room. Sam never had any type of reverb, it just slapback echo, and then the actual rooms.
So just tape echo was the only...
Yeah, tape echo, and then the front room he kind of used as a more reverberant room. But yeah, I had a plate reverb and then the slapback too. But yeah, it's just a different way of recording, you know, less is more with microphones and gear. And
it's a great way to learn what you do now, like coming up through that.
Absolutely.
Place in that system, man.
You have to work harder for that. And then also we had to tear down every night because there would be hundreds of tourists going through there the next day. And
right.
You don't want them touching your microphone. So I had to be able to set up a whole session in about 30-45 minutes every night and bring it back up the next day. And actually, Steve, it was really cool to tear down because obviously you could leave the control room somewhat set up. So you have to start, you know, you have to check everything completely from scratch. But you'd re-put the mics back up and you would always kind of like, I'll still come in the next day and pull up this previous day and then wiggle stuff around a little bit because you hear stuff differently the next day and change stuff. So it was pretty cool to not be, it helped you not be precious about, oh my God, did someone bump the snare mic, you know, like,
yeah. And like they would have been in the 50s there. Like they probably, you know, that probably happened all the time. Where
yeah, and they
like,
even
oh,
have a mic.
Different today.
They wouldn't even have a mic on the snare back then because it was already loud enough.
Right. So did the guy that you learned from there, was he really hip to all the recording techniques that came out of that era in that room?
A little bit. He, you know, he grew up, he got in the studio game much later. So he was much more of like an 80s, 90s. Is where he started really recording. So, you know, the kick drum mic was more inside the kick drum. There was different things. This is not a negative against James at all because he was a phenomenal musician and engineer. But I don't think he was super interested in... He could definitely make it sound, you know, do the slap back and do stuff like that, but he wasn't necessarily interested in going back to live to mono or anything. I think he would embrace it. But I was a little bit more of a...
A purist.
Not purist. I wanted to. I think, you know, I grew up in the time of computer recording and stuff. So when I got there, there was a big 2-inch machine that was just like a big ashtray, and I wanted to hear what that thing sounded like. So I would get it going with the tech, and I would start recording with it. And I finally got him to show me how to align it and stuff, and I would start using it. And then I think once he saw me excited about it and hooking stuff back up, he would get re-excited about it, you know?
Okay. So there wasn't really a guy like teaching you all that stuff. You just kind of like it was there and you were like pulling it out of storage basically and kind of learning it for yourself.
He would teach me some things and some things that he didn't know. I would get a tech in and then, you know, really watch the tech or whoever I could to teach me stuff. And then because it was Sun, we'd also have a lot of outside engineers and producers coming in that you would assist. And so getting them to show me things and stuff like that.
Right.
But yeah, it's never, I never wanted to be a purist because I think that there's no, you can make a record any way possible. And it all depends on the artist and the song and their vision, you know? Mm-hmm. If Kendrick Lamar came in there, I wouldn't be like, well, no, you got to do this to my mono Ampex.
Right, right.
I'd be like, however you want
to
do
it. That's what I loved. Like, I watched some of that Pure Mix thing that you did, and like, I really noticed that, you know, yes, you're using, you know, some of the great analog processing and stuff, but you're totally rocking the Pro Tools rig, too. Like, you're not messing around with that shit.
Yeah, to me, they're all tools. They never works the same way twice. So my biggest heroes are like Willie Mitchell, Chips Moman, and Sam Phillips, and some of these guys, and they all kind of had a sound that they applied to all the artists. And it's funny because as much as I look up to them, that's the last thing I want to do. I would rather you be surprised that you saw me on the back of the thing than going like, oh yeah, they definitely went there and he did that thing he does.
Right. yeah. So how long did you do that for? Like, how long were you at Sun being like the staff engineer?
I was at Sun. I started there at 16, was the intern, and then I became the second engineer. And I think around 2010, I became the head engineer. And then I left.
Oh my God. That's a long time.
Yeah. I left in 2015. So I was there about 11 years or so.
Wow. Okay. What happened around that time? Did it change ownership or anything? Or did you just kind of get sick of doing that, or you wanted to do other things, or how did that happen?
No, I mean, you know, the great thing, Sun obviously is one of the great studios of all time. It is a museum, so it is a museum during the day. I was also the general manager, not the general manager, I think they said I was operations manager, but I was a manager too, so I would get there at 9 a.m. and work till 6 as the museum, and then at 6:30 I would start recording till late at night. So I was working really insane hours, and the thing about Sun is it's busy every day, recording and tourist wise, you know. So and I really love that. I it's helped me since then, now being able to not have as much as sometimes I'd like to have a routine or a schedule. It's been ingrained in my body for so long that, you know, this week you're not going to have dinner till 10, and tomorrow you might have dinner at 5 p.m., and you might not sleep for 2 weeks. So I'm really grateful for that because it's helped with other sessions. I had been kind of thinking about leaving for a while because it's one thing to work in just one room every day and be good, but I really wanted to push myself and see what I could do in other rooms. Also, I didn't want to be just known as the retro Sun guy or something like that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to like, I never want to get lazy or take stuff for granted. And so I thought about leaving for a while and just becoming an independent engineer. And that's when I had started to do a couple sessions outside of the studio. And then,
What were the first sessions you did outside of Sun?
While working at Sun, I worked with the Sheepdogs, this great rock and roll band from Canada.
I'm Canadian, so I know those guys.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, they're awesome. Yeah. And they came down and did like and this is a great lesson, I think, for people who want to get in the business, that everything is an audition, whether you realize it or not. You know, they came in with the CB, is it the CBC that's like the, yeah, CBC?
I remember when this happened, yeah.
With I forget the dang producer's name now, it's killing me. But they came up with a producer, and they came in, and they were just doing a couple songs live to two-track. I talked them into going live to two-track because they, I forget why, but I was crazy at the time. And we did it, and they really loved the sound. They just loved hanging out and stuff, and so they asked me to come record their what would be future nostalgia album. And we rented a barn in Peterborough, and made a in the field kind of record. And so I was up there for 2 weeks, and that was that was basically my 2-week vacation I had it from working as a manager was going to work in Canada. So it was the best vacation
ever. In Peterborough, no less.
In Peterborough, yeah. That record was amazing. We had a big barn. I remember they, like, when they rented it, they were like, there's a lake and there's all this stuff we can do. And I'm like, I'm never going to get to see the lake. I already know it's going to happen. And sure enough, I don't even think I walked down and ever looked at it. I was in the barn recording different people every day. But we rented one of those green egg smokers, and there was a butcher shop in town. So every day, whoever wasn't doing overdub would walk down and get some cut of meat and start smoking it or grilling it, and then we would have a big family dinner every night. It was really cool.
Nice. Yeah, a good bunch of Saskatoon boys.
Yeah, that was one thing. And then I went down to Fame with Dave Cobb called me. We had a mutual friend, Mark Neal, and Dave was doing this great artist, Anderson East, for Spotify at Fame.
Yeah.
And asked if I'd come engineer it. And that's when we were making that about an hour.
So how did that connection happen? Like, that was just out of the blue? You just got a call from Dave?
Dave and I have a mutual friend, Mark Neal, who's a great producer. He did the Black Keys Brothers album and old 97s and stuff. And we were all friends with Mark. Dave and I had met years ago at a recording conference in Nashville that we were both speaking at, but just briefly, like at after late night dinner thing. But I was a fan of his records, and he said he had liked some stuff I've been doing out of Sun, and he wanted someone to come down there and do the Fame session, and so he thought of me. So yeah, he called me to do this one day session at Fame. And a couple hours into it, it was going really good. He asked me to engineer Jason Isbell's What Would Be Something More Than Free album.
Great record.
And so that was going to be like a whole month in February. I asked the Sun owners if I could go do that album, and they were hesitant to have me gone that long as I was doing double duty there. And I kind of told this before, but it was like the hardest and easiest decision at the same time, because I've been there a long time. I really love that studio and the history, and it was a salary job in the music world, which is unheard of. But at the same time, I knew I would regret it forever if I didn't go do this album. So I actually quit my job. Told him I would leave. I didn't just leave the next day. Put in my 2 weeks. I put in my 2 months or whatever it was. And I was happy to train, help whoever I could succeed after me there, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But yeah, I ended up leaving for that album.
And you did that in Nashville, or was that done somewhere else?
We did that in Nashville at Sound Emporium, which, funny enough, is the studio that Cowboy Jack Clement, who was an old Sun studio engineer, started. It was called Jack's Tracks. And then Sun Records, Sam Phillips sold the record label in 69 to a guy named Shelby Singleton. And so Sun Records is in Nashville, and it was next door. So I left Sun Studio to go work next door to Sun Records.
That Sound Emporium is a really cool sounding room. It's, so did you find, like, was it hard for you after working for so long in one room to go into another room? Even a great room like Sound Emporium, it must be like a totally different experience for you. Was it jarring at all?
Definitely a little jarring. You know, I never was used to having an assistant. I was never used to having like a big studio. I mean, in town we have Ardent and stuff where I had done a couple things at, and I'd done some stuff at Royal, but like, you know, Sound Emporium is this big studio with several runners and assistants, and Dave's a big producer and Jason's a big artist. And I knew some of the guys in the band beforehand, but it still was like, you know, I hadn't used any fancy mic. We didn't have fancy mics or gear at Sun. So now there's all these new things to try out and hear. And, you know, the funny thing is, at Sun, when I would get levels, I wouldn't go, hey, hit your kick drum, now hit your snare drum. I'd have to have everybody play together, because it didn't really matter what the kick drum sounded like by itself, because it's in everything else. So I'd have everybody.
That's a great lesson to learn, actually, though, isn't it?
Well, it's funny, because in Nashville, you get all this, you check everything the day before, and then you sit and you make all these decisions kind of on stuff before you hear everybody in the room together. I appreciate it. You get your levels and you're all prepared and ready to go. But I was kind of hesitant to make decisions till I heard everybody play together, you know? And so I think that was a lot different for them sometimes to understand. But in on that session, we had stuff baffled off, so it didn't matter so much. But I was so used to, like, I don't know what the EQ the guitar till I hear what it's doing with the other.
Yeah. So, well, of course. Yeah. So how was that for you working with a producer? Like, I know that you produce your own stuff and sometimes you just engineer. Like, what's the dynamic like when you work with somebody like Dave Cobb as far as, you know, how simpatico are you guys? It seems like you guys aesthetically are on the same page, so it was probably pretty easy. But is there a lot of sort of going back and forth about sonically what you're after on a record like that?
I love working with anybody and everybody, like Steve Berlin, who I saw you talk to too. We did, he produced a thing I engineered on the Blind Boys of Alabama and stuff. So I love working with other producers and engineers because I never, like I said, I never want to get into a routine or just, I always love learning new things or seeing how other people approach things in their way. Cause you, it's just amazing how many, you know, how everybody attacks stuff or just hears things. One of my favorite things is like, having the client in the room when you mix or whatever and just hearing how they hear something, it makes me hear something different. So I get inspired by all that. So working with Dave was great. Dave is, you know, I would have been fired pretty quickly if they were just wanting someone to copy and paste stuff to a click track and slide drums around and auto-tune. I'm not good at that stuff, or I'm not fast at that stuff. And I really don't... I'll do anything that a song needs, but that's not something that I super look forward to. Dave likes to record everybody live in the room and is very organic, and he'll let me fire up the tape machine, or he'll want to fire up the tape machine and stuff. So working with Dave was great. Dave is very hands-on. So like those two Isbell records we did is, you know, Dave is really, one thing I love about him, he's got amazing ears and he knows how gear sounds, like specific, and at that time I didn't because I'd only worked in Sun so much, you know. So he'd be like,
"So you were like learning a lot of that gear like on the fly."
Yeah, they had an EVR, which I knew from Arden a little bit, but actually Dave wanted to skip an EVR, so I showed up and Dave had brought in racks of his gear, you know, and but he, like I said, he's a very hands-on producer. So he'd be like, let's do the drums through the knees. I want to hear the bass through the blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, you get that all going. And then he'll reach over and be grabbing EQs while you're pulling stuff up. So that stuff doesn't bother me at all. I'm not precious about, like, hold on, I'm engineering, you know. So it was fun to tag team and stuff.
And then when he's producing, he's usually in there, like he plays guitar and stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like acoustic guitar or whatever. So you're kind of left alone in the control room.
All alone.
And are those records are probably done like fairly quickly, or are they pretty experimental? Or?
Yeah, even, I mean, we still experiment pretty much, but yeah, it's getting two or three songs a day and then working real fast. And
I know that he sort of talks about how he liked to work without headphones and stuff. Did you do those Isbell records like in the room without headphones? Is that really?
No, they had headphones. They used headphones on that session. But a lot of times it's not a bunch of more me's, you know, you give everyone up.
Yeah.
At Sam Phillips, where I'm at now, at Sun, I did almost most of the sessions without headphones. I would have a little Altec speaker kind of set up in, because if you're playing too loud in that room, everything's screwed anyway. So playing without headphones and having a speaker really helped control the volume in the room and also make people play differently. Margot's Midwest Farmer's Daughter album was done without headphones. And then at the new Sam Phillips studio, they have an old school headphone system where everyone shares the same 2-mix and you don't even get to control your volume. You share
oh, really?
The same volume. Yeah. And it's kind of amazing. It's really amazing. No one ever complains about it. No one's like fiddling with stuff in between songs, you know what everyone's getting because it's what I'm hearing in the control room. It makes me work better because I'm sitting there writing the faders as they're listening, so they make sure everyone gets the solo feels to pop up and the vocal feels popped up, and then I really learn all the moves I want to do in the song and know the overdubs I need to do while I'm tracking because I'm so focused on that, you know. A lot of the Jason stuff would be like everyone shares the same 2-mix or whatever. So it's kind of like, in a sense, it's like playing without headphones because they can't just turn themselves up. A lot of that stuff was with headphones.
Interesting. So that Margot Price record that you mentioned, so how did that come about? Because so at that point, I don't know if that's her first record, but that's the first record that I ever heard of
hers. Yeah, she had another band, but that was the first record as Margo Price. So again, everything's an audition. They at the studio, we would get calls, you know, about recording, and I was as flexible. I would record you anytime, anywhere. Yeah. We could, and she just called up the studio, and they were driving back from South by Southwest, and they wanted to record for 2 hours, but they couldn't get there till like 11:30 at night or something. I was like, "Let's do it! I'm ready to go." So we recorded, and she came.
Oh, so that was at Sun.
That was at Sun. Yeah, that's when I was still the engineer there. They were cool with going to my 1-inch 8-track, and so we recorded the 8-track, and I was just blown away by her. I just thought she was incredible. And yeah. We didn't get much done that night. They were kind of tired from the drive, and she didn't have the band that she has now. It was close to it, but not it yet. Mm-hmm. But I just kind of we became fast friends in 2 hours, me and her husband Jeremy, and we kind of kept in touch, and I just told him, I said, if you ever want to come back and record, you know, I can make it, you know, I can't do it for free, because I would do me for free, but I can't, the studio, I have to, you know, get blah, 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 but I, so I'll make it as cheap as I possibly can for whatever you want to do. And so she called back about a couple months later and said she's ready to book 3 days and do an album. So that's when we did Midwest Farmer's Daughter, and we recorded.
And that record was probably done like on a shoestring, right? Because it wasn't.
Yeah,
she ended up licensing it to Third Man. Like, she probably didn't really have a budget, or.
Yeah, I basically just did it. The studio just got whatever the cheapest I could get the owner to go on the studio. And then she turned out they pawned her wedding ring and sold one of her cars to fund the band and the rooming and stuff.
Classic.
But put her all into it, and we cut the whole thing in 3 days, starting at 6 o'clock at night, and
I think all at Sun.
Yeah, all at Sun. And then they did a couple overdubs back home after they left, like small things like percussion and stuff. And then I mixed it. We tracked it, and then I think by the time we mixed it, it was several months later, and I had actually left Sun by that time, and so okay. I mixed it at Ardent Studio B. And then Jack White and them picked it up, which was amazing.
So that was done without headphones. Does she, like, as a singer, is that a struggle? I know, like, I've had certain experiences doing headphoneless recordings where for some singers, like, it's really a challenge because they just can't get that thing that they want to feel from either from headphones or from a monitor that they get from a live gig.
Yeah.
But she has a pretty powerful voice.
She has a powerful voice. And like, if she had any trouble, we always start without the headphones. And sometimes it's a song by song basis. You know, if they need the headphones, yeah. I will go immediately out there and put it on there. Like I said, I'm not forcing anyone into some weird way of recording that they don't like. So it's kind of finding their level of, but once you got the Altec speaker, right. And in that room, just being in Sun, I can't describe it, but it's like, that room,
so the Altec, you're treating it like a vocal monitor. It's like a speaker coming back at the singer.
Yeah. And it also gives energy to the other stuff in the room, you know? So, she was typically pretty happy with that when we would just go. There's a song, I can't remember if there's a song that we, I think maybe 4 years of Chances or one song where we were up in the ante a little bit. We went to a headphone, I think, for them. But that
so she would have done all her vocals live off the floor pretty much with the band.
Yeah. I think she punched a couple things later. If you Hurting on a Bottle, that's like, I think we did two takes, and both takes I thought take one was it, but the pedal steel player didn't like his solo, so we did take two. And then I can't remember if we went which one we went with, but both takes were phenomenal. She's just a killer singer, just incredible. Yeah.
What about the Prion album, since we were talking about the Dave Cobb connection? So you guys did that great John Prion record a few years back. What was working with him like?
Amazing. So John recorded Pink Cadillac at Sam Phillips, a studio.
That's right. Yeah, I forgot about that.
And Margo and Jeremy we had done Margo and Jeremy's second album, All American Made, at Sam Phillips, and they became friends with Prine after that. And then I never had met John, but I was friends with obviously the Phillips family and Keith Sykes and some of his other friends. And Margo and Jeremy had told him about Phillips and me, I guess, down here, because the first day at meeting John at the studio, I said, John, I work down at Sam Phillips Recording Service. Jerry told me to tell you, hey, and you know, we're love for you to come seeing is it hasn't changed or something. He goes, yeah, Margo and Jeremy told me I got to meet a guy down there who recorded their album. I goes, well, I think that was me. He's like, oh man. And he's like, called his wife over. He's like, this is the guy down at Phillips or whatever. And so it was just an amazing, he's one of a kind. Him and Fiona and his sons and family, they're just like, they emanate nothing but love. They immediately welcome you in like you're a second cousin coming for Thanksgiving, and that was just one of the greatest 2 weeks of my life was with spending with them every day working on that record.
And that was done at Dave Cobb's place.
That was done at RCAA, after that album, John and his family came down and visited Sam Phillips, and he actually cried seeing the studio because it hasn't changed since he recorded there, and that album meant so much to him. So we had a great time hanging out for the day. In the studio.
Beautiful. And so that record that you did at RCA, that's a gigantic room. I can't believe how huge it is. I mean, I know there's bigger rooms, but you know, I'm not used to working in rooms that big. Was that a struggle at all? Like just dealing with acoustic instruments and voices and stuff in a room that big, or is the room just so amazing? That
no,
really
what's
matter?
Funny about it is we just put everyone in a circle there. Everyone was probably 3 feet from each other in a big circle.
I've seen pictures of the session. So yeah, I kind of knew that.
Yeah. I've never actually, Dave really likes it kind of like that in that room. So I've never like really spread things too far out in that room, but yeah, it's a massive, massive room, but it just sounds so good in there. You know, that's Sun, RCAA, RCAB, Motown. They were built before headphones were around. So there's a lot of the acoustics, like when you see the horizontal slats, is to reflect or soften sound depending on if an artist is sitting down or standing up. They thought about that stuff in advance to help sound travel, and so you could hear everything naturally in the room without headphones or anything, because some of those rooms were built before headphones were around. Like that's some of the best rooms to record acoustic material in.
Interesting. And John doesn't strike me as somebody who would want to sit there doing a song over and over again. Is it all pretty much like first, second, third takes kind of thing?
He would get them fast for sure, but there was a song or two that the song didn't make the album, but he sang it several times to try and get the feeling right. So he would do as many times as Dave asked him to. But often those guys are so good it didn't take but 1 to 3 takes to get it.
Can you give me a quick rundown of the Sam Phillips studio situation versus the so he left Sun in what year?
So Sam started you're gonna get a long-winded answer, I hope it was okay. Sam started Sun in 1950. He had basically no money. He rented the space, he built the acoustics in there. It was a three-room building. He didn't even have an office. And he had two kids, a deaf mute aunt, and a wife he was taking care of. And mm-hmm. he had a prestigious job at the Peabody recording big band music for WREC radio station.
Oh.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
In the ballroom.
Oh, cool.
And he left that job to start the studio. And it's, I think a lot of people not super familiar with it just think he was a lucky kind of hillbilly guy that stumbled upon Elvis Presley. But Sam grew up in Alabama, kind of a sharecropper son, and immediately loved radio. First he wanted to be a civil rights lawyer almost, but then he, like To Kill a Mockingbird or something, you know, but he quickly fell in love with radio, and he went to Nashville for a while, and he came to Memphis, and he came through Memphis as a kid on the way to, I think, a Bible camp or something, and he said they drove past Beale Street at like 4 a.m. And Beale Street, Memphis is so much different than any other southern town. Memphis has a much larger, diverse population, and we had the blues, and we had all this other stuff happening, rock and roll before it was called rock and roll. And Beale Street, whites weren't allowed on Beale Street. Beale Street was like kind of like, I hate to use the word Vegas, but it was basically a retreat that any African-American anywhere around could come and go to. And there was clubs, there was drinking, there was, I'm sure there was, you know, prostitute, whatever you wanted to do. You could go on Beale Street, and it's like probably the one of the few times they could let their hair down, so to speak, and relax and not worry about all the segregation and all the racism outside and all the other hardships of life. And Sam drove by Beale Street and saw this and was immediately intrigued by it. And then when he moved here, he was recording all the big band music. The Peabody is not too far from Beale Street, and he was hearing, I mean, at that time you could hear Howlin' Wolf, B.B. King, Ike Turner, amazing, you know, Joe Cotton, Lil Walter, all this stuff. So that was emanating down the street, and that's all he could focus on. That was what was speaking to him, was this black music, and no one was recording it. No one was appreciating it in as far as whites go. So he left this prestigious job to start a studio to record, you know, predominantly black music in the 50s. So it was not a, this was not a quick money-making scheme or anything. This was just doing what his soul was telling him to do. Mm-hmm. And so he started recording all these great black artists, and he was selling the master's licenses to Chess or RPM. But then they eventually were starting having big hits with it, and he was only getting the one-time fee, and they wouldn't appreciate some of the real raw stuff he would send. So he decided to start his own record label. And that was, so the studio was called Memphis Recording Service, and the record label was called Sun Records. He started Sun Records in 52. It was not a success at all for several years. He actually put out he had a hit with Rufus Thomas called Bearcat. It was a ripoff of Hound Dog. But back then, blues artists would all the time take a song. It was called Answer Song. It was quite popular. But Sam was the first one to get sued for it. Yeah, he got sued and it almost financially destroyed him. And then he discovered Elvis. And by 53, you know, Elvis had come in there and recorded. And, you know, he famously sold Elvis's contract a year and a half later to RCA for $30,000. And he said he never regretted that decision. You know, his dream was to bring black music to make it universal, to not make it just, they were calling them race records or whatever, but he wanted everyone to listen to black music. And so that was his dream. His dream wasn't just Elvis. Elvis was someone who came along and helped facilitate that dream because he made it acceptable for white kids to listen to, you know, he was the gateway drug into Howlin' Wolf or whatever. But selling Elvis's contract, that $30,000, that was a lot of money at the time. It was the highest paid for country and Western artist by that point. And that money helped get the debts from the lawsuit and fix stuff up around the studio and allowed him to get international distribution and stuff because he had only had local distribution with the record. So it really saved the label. And so then Johnny Cash, Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Roy Orbison, Conway Twitty, all these guys come through the door. And then they have those hits, you know. And Elvis was only a regional success on Sun. He sells the contract to RCA. RCA puts out Heartbreak Hotel, which to Sam is a horrible record. It's sad. It sounds bad. Didn't have it. They couldn't figure out how to do his echo, so they put the voice in the hallway. And then Sam puts out Blue Suede Shoes, and it's the first record to be top 10 on all three charts. So RCA, for a while, thought they signed the wrong guy, you know? But Sam had all this success, and so by 57, he had made $1 million. There was a little local newspaper article saying he made, Sam Phillips made $1 million without an office or something. But if you also got to think, technologically speaking, when Sam started, he didn't have magnetic tape. He was recording direct to disc. By 51, 52, he had a single track Ampex. But by 58, you know, they're starting to get into three track. They're starting to get echo chambers. There's plate reverb. There's all these things coming out, condenser microphones. So he really wanted to expand his business and his sound. So he started building his dream studio one street down, three blocks down, and that's Sam Phillips Recording Service. So he started building it about 5758. It officially opened in 1960. It's unchanged. I'm in Studio B right now, but it's still the same paint, still the same shag carpet everywhere. And it's really an amazing room. Sam spared no expense. He spent $800,000 in 1958 money.
Which Holy is shit.
Absolutely. And it was probably the most futurist high-tech studio, I think, till for a long, long time. I mean, other people have, there's been trends in audio, but he built a room that sounds beautiful when you're in it. He designed these doors. You can see these doors. They open and close, and you can make the room more reflective or more absorptive by closing the door, opening the door. He had two studios, two lathe rooms. There was several offices. There's three echo chambers and then a penthouse suite with a bar in his office. And his office has a built-in jukebox in the desk. I mean, just incredible studio. And that's where he officially moved to in 1960. Woolly Bully was cut here. The Yardbirds did Train Kept a Rollin' and a couple other songs in here. The Cramps cut in here. Mr. Bojangles' Third Rate Romance was cut in there. Some of Shotgun Willie was cut in here. John Prine did Pink Cadillac. Alex Chilton did Flies Like Sherbert. Phil Collins did a record with Robert Plant in the 80s at some point. Just a lot of crazy records were cut in here.
Was it always called Sam Phillips
Recording? Yeah, Sam Phillips Recording Service, yeah.
And so how did it come about that you ended up there? Just through the Sun connection, or like what's the story?
I was friends with the Phillips family by Sun. You know, Sam never owned the building of Sun. He rented that room for 9 years and he moved to Sam Phillips. And so he moved, the record label moved, but the studio stayed there. And later it was a barber shop and it was a scuba shop. And then now it's a studio again. But the Phillips family would come in quite a bit. And I always looked up to them. I never got to meet Sam. Sam died in 2003. I started working at Sun in 2004. But his sons, Jerry and Knox, would come in. And they have that, you know, if Sam was Yoda, Jerry and Knox would be like Obi-Wan Kenobi. You know, they still have that. They still have the force with them. So they have this thing about them when they come into a room. And they're just such amazing people. And so I got to be friends with them. And Roland Janes was the engineer of Phillips for a long time. And he was the guitar player on all the 50s, like Jerry Lee Sun stuff. He really was one of the first rock and roll guitar players. He's the first guy to have a Stratocaster in Memphis. He did the out of phase pickup thing. And he really was those early licks you hear on Billy Lee Riley and Jerry Lee. That's Roland. So he really changed guitar playing. And now he was an engineer at Phillips. So you go over there just to see Roland. And it was kind of like a rite of passage thing. So I would walk down and hail Roland a little bit. And then he passed away in 2015, right as I was going independent. And so I needed a place to kind of move my gear and have a home base. So I talked to the Phillips family and they weren't sure what to do. So I moved into Phillips and was bringing clients into A, and then I turned the B room into like a little mix room because my buddy Jeff Powell came over also too from Ardent, and he cuts vinyl records. So he moved his Neumann lathe over and he cuts records in the Studio B control room, and I mix in the Studio B tracking room.
So the Phillips family still owns it and you just rent it from them? Is that what happens?
The Phillips family owns the building. I just rent the B room from them. I'm actually stupidly building building a studio now. So I'll be leaving soon from I'll still track in A when it's right to, but I won't be renting the B room very much longer. But yeah, I rent the B room and mix in there, but I book their A room from them when I want to track or something.
So what's the story with the place that you're building? Is it right in Memphis? And like what's the layout of it?
This really amazing thing happened. I worked with this artist, John Kilzer, and he was an amazing man. He was a big basketball player, super tall guy in college. And then he was a great singer-songwriter in the 80s. He was going to be like the next big thing. He was signed to Geffen. He put out this amazing record, and he unfortunately had some bad luck in the music business, and also he had alcohol and drug issues. And he never quit doing music, but he became a recovery minister. And he's done several records, and all of them are just phenomenal. And I finally got to work with him on his last record. It's this record called Scars. And at the time we were working on it, we knew we were... You know, you knew he was special, and the songs were special, and we became close as you do in recording, and he kept telling me, you got to go over to this Crosstown place, and I'd heard about it, but I just had never gone, and he's like, I want you to come over there and meet the folks there, and just...
It's a studio.
No, it's just, it was in the 50s, it was built in 1906, it's 1.5 million square foot Art Deco concrete massive building. It was a Sears distribution center.
Wow.
And so it had Sears, but it was also where they, you know, just distribute all their stuff around town. There's one in LA. I think there was one in New York, and there's some of them are still around because they're these massive concrete buildings you can't get rid of.
Feet. Yeah. I can't even conceive of how big that is.
I think it's actually 1.5 million or something crazy, but it was empty after, I forget when it became like abandoned, but at some point like in the 80s or something, this building was emptied, and it's just been kind of a sore spot in this midtown Memphis, you know, this big, because they know no one knew what to do with it. It was too expensive to tear it down. And this amazing guys came in there and turned it into this creative cultural center.
Wow.
So they fixed it all up. They redid the plumbing, the HVAC, the electricity. And now you go in there and the top three levels are apartments. There's four or five restaurants. There's all these local businesses. There's a radio station out of the bottom floor now. There's a 500-seat music theater venue in the back. There's a green room, which is kind of like a songwriter's, like a Bluebird kind of room. There's a bar. There's a high school in there. I mean, it's just the most amazing thing. St. Jude's got offices there. There's a brewery. And so it's this amazing place of all these creative people. And they put in a couple rooms of Pro Tools computers, Photoshop computers, video editing software. There's a big woodworking lathe. There's a huge expensive 3D and photo printers in there. And for like $80 a month, you can go in there and use any of that stuff as much as you want.
Wow.
So you get all these people in there doing all this amazing stuff. And so I've worked with John Kilzer. He got me to go meet the folks over there, and they had some space. There's like 10,000 square feet of space left in the building that they weren't sure what to do with. And they wanted to do something very cool with it. And I met them, and kind of like when I was thinking about leaving Sun, I've always had the dream of having my own studio, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've been at Philips a long time, and I would work in A, but I've kind of accumulated all this funky gear, and I have a way of how I think sound should be and acoustics should be now. I've kind of, after hearing all these different studios, so I was always kind of looking at maybe finding my own space. And I met, and John made me meet these guys. This is the right time. And then unfortunately, John had some, always had he'd been sober for a long time, but you know, the demons are still there. And he, unfortunately, he killed himself just after our album came out. And it was a big, heavy blow. And it brought me and the guys at Crosstown even closer together, because of our mutual friend John, who had put us together. So it was this weird kind of spiritual things all lining up. But I ended up kind of dreaming with them about this space for a while, and then I decided to do it. And so I'm renting about 3,000 square feet and building a studio inside that space. And then another thing that happened that's amazing is John King, who is one of the founders of Ardent, and just kind of a silent partner, he has one of the world's biggest vinyl collections. It's worth over $1 million. It's over 100,000 records. He collected basically every top like 10 or 20 records since the 60s. He's collected them. And he's getting up there in age, and he was trying to donate them to like a college, and they weren't interested in taking the catalog without, I forget what else they wanted. So the guys at Crosstown took this catalog on, and Jim Thompson, who's become a dear friend of mine, he owns Eggleston Speaker Works, and they're a Memphis company that makes incredible hi-fi speakers. He's donating a pair of like $80,000 audiophile speakers to the space. So when you go up to the second floor at Crosstown, down this hallway, there'll be about a, I think it's a 4,500 square foot vinyl library open to the public.
Wow.
And okay. we've gotten other labels and stuff to donate records. So you'll go in there and we'll have a guy obviously curating it. So you can't just pull the rare, the rarest blues 78 off the shelf, but you can bring in records. You can pull one off the shelf. There are 10 to 12 turntables with headphones that you can listen privately. There's a sample room. So if you want to sample a drum groove off this rare record for your song, there's that. And then there's a listening room that'll seat about 50 people with these speakers with a big view outside of Memphis.
And
I'm side by side with that. So all these things have lined up. And it's just what I'd hoped for because I feed off of other people. I hate being in a room by myself. And so this to have a 1.5 million square foot building with artists and photographers and writers.
That's crazy.
And stuff. And now there's a radio station. So I've really thought this that Memphis definitely didn't need another studio, but the having this as the place for it, as you know. I'm jumping all around here, so I apologize. But you know, when you got people in the studio, they sometimes need to get out, but they feel like they can't leave because they might have to go do a tambourine real quick or something.
Right.
Well, they can leave my door of the studio, and they literally have 1 million square feet. They can go get a coffee, go sit outside, get a book without leaving the studio, so to speak. So, and they can live upstairs and then they can come play a show at the theater, then come record. And then there's a radio station down there and there's all this amazing kind of charity stuff that we all donate our time to for Crosstown that for the school or for St. Jude or whatever. And so I feel like it's one of these, it could be like the most classy feel good cruise ship. All inclusive thing because you can come in and do this stuff. So it really turned out well. And to have this vinyl library side by side, it's like, what better way to go start a session than go in there and listen to your favorite record on these speakers that you've never heard it before and remember what you love about music, then go make music, and then we can go play it on the radio or talk about it, and then you can go play a show for people. I just think
That get wired on some artisanal coffee.
Yeah, exactly. Get your your organic free-range beans. And
so you had basically a blank slate to create your own space then?
Somewhat. I mean, obviously there's financial slates, and then it's an old Sears building, so every 17 foot is a 3 foot thick concrete column. So working around those columns, at first I was annoyed by it, but I wanted to hide some of them. But you can't do that, so to speak. But then it became amazing because we have this control room, and sight lines is a big thing for me. So the tracking room kind of curls around the control room window a little bit. So the tracking room is 35 feet wide, 23 feet deep, but it curls. So you only feel like you're like within 12 foot of somebody at all times.
And that's not gigantic. That's a nice size.
It's a nice size, yeah. And then this one column right in the middle, it's concrete and smooth. And it's circular, so sound will bounce off of that randomly every time. There's no way to calculate it. So we have one of those in the main room. Then all the other concrete columns are kind of half-moon-shaped throughout. I designed a long hallway with them, too, and they help break out the sound as like a big chamber. So I'm really excited to see how it will turn out.
And when is that all going to be up and running?
They're moving fast now. We're hoping to start running pulling cable and installing the patch bays and stuff in April or late April. And I'll probably be actually getting sounds then or May.
So quickly.
Yeah. It's been in the cards for a long time. I haven't really, I didn't feel like posting about it in 2020 because we all had so much horrible stuff happening to us in 2020 and be like, well, I'm building a studio. Look at me. So I waited till 2021 with all the feels like the clouds had lifted some, even though we're somewhat still in 2020 in so many ways. But
yeah. Is it going to be a commercial space or is it just like your space for doing your projects?
I kind of view it as both. You know, I travel a lot for work. I love recording in other towns and other places. So I don't want it to just be shut out to anybody and everybody, but I will be somewhat picky about who gets to go in there while I'm not in there because there's a lot of historic stuff. And I just don't want stuff to get beat up and certain things. Right. But no, I haven't fully... I say that now, and then when I can't pay the rent, I'll be trying to get anybody there. But
you mentioned some of the equipment, and we don't really like focus on gear on this podcast, but like, what are the centerpiece things for you? Like, you must have a console that you love and that you're used to working on, or what's your general centerpiece bits of equipment?
It's funny, I'm sure with you too, like, you know, we were talking about the microphones we're talking on for this podcast, but like, I absolutely love gear, and at the same time, I'm not picky about it because I know that the cheapest thing in that room, in that studio that I'm going to work at, like I can't bring my console, but I'll use there. And that thing will be, that funky thing will get the sound that I couldn't have gotten well in the nice gear. So I always love hearing new stuff. And like I said, I never want the records to all sound the same. So
yeah,
I love working on different pieces, but I have, a Spectrasonics console from 1969 that was made in Memphis, and it was one of five made. And then I also, several years ago, acquired the original Ardent desk. John had sold it in the 70s, and it's the record that Big Star did their first two records on. Isaac Hayes' Hot Buttered Soul, I believe, was mixed on it and tracked on it. And
is it a Spectra as well?
Yeah, it's an early Spectra. It was made in Memphis under the company Autotronics, but it was all Spectrasonics parts. And that console was the sister console to the Stax board, because John thought if I got the same console that Stax has and the same A-track, when they start getting busy, I'll get their overflow work. And that's how Ardent really started getting busy at the beginning. So the board's it's been getting worked on for several years. It had a lot of just like, over the years, it was all there, but it had some issues. So I wanted to get it completely overhauled because it's going to be the centerpiece at the new room. So
how big is it?
It's not big. It's only 12 channels. It's a 12x4. But I've stupidly have added automated faders to the below it. It has those old Altec slide faders, which I kept for the mic pre to tape in. But I have automated faders now because I love to mix as I go. I try to mix as we're tracking, and so I want to be able to save the mix and save the moment and then come back.
I love the automation too. I've got that on my board.
Yeah, it's key.
It is good. Yeah. What's the general deal with the Spectra stuff? Like, I know it's sort of known for like being able to kind of deal with really fast transients and stuff like that. Is it a really unique sounding console?
You know, it you're going through transformers, and you're going, so it will color. It distorts amazingly. It's got like a very musical tube, almost the kind of saturation. But what I love about it is my console, and I'm not a super technical person, but how many times have you like, you go out and you put a mic on the kick drum and you're like, okay, even with your ear, you go, this is what the kick drum sounds like. Then you go back into the room and you pull up the fader and you go, okay, that doesn't sound like what I just heard out there. And you're debating, is the microphone, is it a bad cable, is it the console? Yeah. And Jim Dickinson, you know, is to say like, you know why records don't sound good anymore? They're going through all this bullshit, you know? And the Spectra boards are all discrete. The ones I have are all discrete, so no ICs. And they have four capacitors in every channel. So it's literally the shortest signal path I've found. It's not going through anything negative. It's going through four capacitors. It's going through two transformers and an inductor EQ. And it just sounds like what I heard out there. Like, I go out and hear the kick drum, I come back in and I hear it, and then if I want to distort it, it distorts beautifully.
Yeah,
that's not saying that's the end-all be-all for me, because I just worked in Nashville on a Sphere console that I've worked on twice, and that thing blows me away.
Really?
With how fuzzy it is. It's a great kind of fuzz. So it's not always the thing that works, but I just love it. A lot of my favorite records were cut on it, and it's just a real musical board to me.
Cool. And they're making equipment again.
Yeah, I'm friends with the owner, so they never really shut down, and they still make equipment. They're great guys. I don't know any other company that I can send my power supplies or my channel to from 1969 and they still make the parts to fix them.
That's amazing.
It's pretty incredible that they still do that stuff, and they haven't futzed with the design too much.
Are you still taking on a lot of projects that you mix where you had nothing to do with the tracking of?
Absolutely.
I know you've done that a lot in the past. Yeah. How that works for you? Like, do you ever get stuff that is so far from what you would have done that you don't know how to deal with it or anything? Or is it generally a positive experience?
Well, I think, Steve, I start every mix project even the ones I've tracked, like, I'm ruining this. Why would you ever hire me to do this? When I'm mixing, I'm looking for the emotion, and I'm a sensitive person. So like I will sit there and I'll listen to all the music, and then I'll listen, because I feel like you always come to it. And when you're in the mixture, you come to it technically first. So you go like, oh, okay, the drums sound phasey. Okay, their bass sounds, I got to denoise that bass. The vocal, I can make it brighter. But shutting all that down, after I got to go back and listen to it several times. And instead of just starting to grab stuff, I listen for the intent of the music and stuff. And I always try and get them to sit with me. I even make it cheaper if they'll come sit with me on like the last 2 days. I usually do is I'll say, give me two or three.
It saves you having to recall and stuff, I guess.
Well, not even that, but like what I feel like happens in today's world, and this could be me projecting my own insecurities and my issues. But I feel like today you mix something and you get to where it feels great, but it never feels like, I'm done with it. This is it. And then, because you mix and you're like, I should just send this before I do anything crazy because I got to hear if I'm on the right track or not.
Right.
Because you never know with people sometimes, especially when you haven't worked on any of it. So what ends up happening is you send a track that's like maybe 80%, 85% there. Then they come back to you with notes, whether their notes are, that's amazing, I think it's done, or just turn the bass up, or I think it needs to be completely blah, 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 blah. You never go back and go, oh, cool, they like it. Now let me try all this crazy stuff. You end up just kind of doing the little notes, doing a couple things and printing it. And so what I always ask them to do is give me like 3 days to go through all the tracks. I organize them how I would do them. I put them on the board, find the equipment and the things I like for the sounds, do some rough things. I'm like you, I ride the faders more than I compress or EQ. It's all about making stuff move. So I get a lot of that out of the way. Then I ask them to come sit for 2 days and I'll play it for them. And as you know, it's this weird thing that happens when you play a song for somebody else. All of a sudden you hear it differently, I can't tell you how many times I've tracked something, mixed something like, this is killer. Then you're like, hey, come listen to the song. And you're like, oh my God, the intro's too long. Nothing happens. I need to fade it out faster. The chorus isn't popping.
It is a different perspective.
The vocal's not loud enough. It's a whole new world just when someone sits in the room. So I love having the client come down and just, I'll hit play for them and I'll immediately hear like, so differently, and all these little things I could do, and transitions or stuff. And I love just go, hey, I hear this sounding like an old 8mm film here, but then we go stereo on the, or whatever. It all that stuff just immediately comes by just their presence that doesn't happen over emails, And so in those 2 days, we can tweak 12 songs and do all these little magical things to me that when I leave it, I'm like, that mix is, I love it.
Slamming.
And they love it. And if they go home and they listen on speakers they're familiar with and they want to recall, I have no problem doing it because I know we've really gotten somewhere. So I always try and get them in here. But I love mixing stuff that other people have recorded. It does take me sometimes longer than stuff I've done because I make so many decisions as we go. But I love it because it's stuff that I didn't record. So it's like, different EQ points I'm looking for, like I'm not familiar, because I know what this room does to certain things, and then like I get some stuff that's really modern that like the echo chamber here is beautiful, but on this recent record the echo chamber sounded too good for what they needed, so I was busting out like the H3000. I haven't used that reverb in 5 years, and I loved it. I was trying to find these like 90s kind of snare plates and stuff, and I just I loved every second of it. So I love getting other people's stuff.
Do you have to vet it at all? Like, do you want to make sure that you know that what you're getting into is something that you feel that you can attach yourself to?
Absolutely. I love my manager Tracy. One thing I love about her too is when someone sends us something, they always say, well, what's Matt Ray? We're interested in mixing 3 songs, and we always start with, send us the songs. And I just want to make sure I connect with it emotionally, but first, and then I'll call them and I like to have a talk or two and A, see if I can get them to come visit, and then B, like kind of what I'm hearing or what they're hearing. Because nowadays it's hard. Sometimes people think that their rough mix is it.
Right.
And they just make it better. And some people don't like what they recorded at all and expect you to you know, change it into a waltz and and add a hip-hop beat on it and stuff like that. Yeah. So kind of feeling that stuff out. Making sure that we're on the same page kind of emotionally. And usually we are, so then it's fun to do it.
What was the session like that you mixed for it, the Elvis stuff that had been recorded in the 70s? That, I mean, that sort of the same thing, but also like totally wildly different with probably crazy expectations attached to it.
It's been amazing. So the first, I've gotten to do, I think, 5 or 6 Elvis box sets now. The first one was 76, what he recorded in the jungle room. He
got How tired, crazy is that?
Yeah, he got tired of going to Nashville, so they recorded him in the jungle room. And it sounded phenomenal. It was 16 track, but I only had 14. They printed the rough mix onto two. And that stuff was great because it was...
it was recorded really well and stuff?
It was recorded really well. I mean, yeah, sometimes stuff, you know, there's distortion or tape clips or you know, mm-hmm. noises, stuff like that. Like in Elvis, where, so I'm using the Mike Elvis would sing in a lot of RE15, but he would wear rings and these things would just knock on the mic. And
really,
yeah, oh god, yeah, he would just like, you'd hear all these clacking on the mics. But
so you have to clean that stuff up or do you just leave it?
You do sometimes. They would print the reverb to the vocal a lot of times, so if you took out the initial transient hit, you would still hear it reverberating, and then that's even a weirder sound.
That's crazy.
But that was the first one I did, so that was studio stuff. And then we did a bunch of live recordings, and that was interesting. And the one of them was an 8-track from 69 Vegas, where you had full strings, amazing, horns, all in 8 tracks. And then the 70s stuff you're referring to that came out this year, that was one of my favorites because it was cut in Studio B with Jerry Carrigan, Norbert Putnam, James Burton, Chip Young, Charlie McCoy. And what we did was like Ernst Jorgensen, who's the producer, along with Rob Santos on the projects, they wanted to do a Let It Be Naked. So we stripped off all the overdubs. And so that's from like the Elvis Country album and stuff. And they would go and record with this hot band and get this amazing take. They did 42 songs in 6 days or something crazy, 42 master takes. Then they would go back and put vibraphone, Celeste, strings, background vocals, all this stuff on there. And when you strip that stuff away, it's just killer.
A kick-ass country album.
Yeah, and you really hear how much he's singing and stuff, you know? It was fun to strip all that stuff back.
Man, pulling up those tracks and having an Elvis track must be beyond description.
Yeah, and it's oftentimes it's, you know, 4 or 5 CDs, so you're working on it for a month. You're working on it for like a month and a half. And so like somewhere in like week 3, you'll come in and you're like, you know, you're just kind of not going through the motions, but you're not paying, you know, you can't every day realize what a great day it is at first.
Right.
And then you'll go, and because of the echo chamber here in the hallway, Elvis's voice is in the chamber, and I'll go get up to pee or like get a banana. And then you just hear Elvis echoing through the building, and you go, shit, man, like this is wild. I still can't believe it. And I still I don't think you'll ever settle in. I'm getting to work on Elvis stuff. It's just
it is something else, man.
It's been I can't thank the guys at Sony enough for sending that to me. And they've let me do some Lou Reed stuff and some Kris Kristofferson stuff now. And I knew a lot of the guys in the band. Like, I know James Burton, I know Norbert Putnam. And so to know those guys for a couple of years and then get to work on it and solo out some of their stuff, it's just...
Is it like James Burton and those guys on the Jungle Room stuff?
Yeah. That was more the TCB band a little bit. So you had Glenn Hardin, you had David Briggs. David Briggs is on some of the Studio B stuff too. And that was Ronnie Tutt on drums. And then Jerry Scheff would be on bass. Norbert did like 3 days, I think, or 3 songs on the Jungle Room stuff. Amazing. But all just killer. And then to get to hear the in-between talk, you know, the outtakes, which we leave in the box sets. You can hear a lot in the box sets and stuff, and it's just phenomenal.
Well, listen, I don't want to keep you. I do want to just quickly ask you about working with Al Green, though, too. I know you did that recently. That was just, as far as I know, it's just one song, right?
Yeah, we were talking about I tried to get him to do another one that day. I was trying to be sneaky. I'm like, yeah, another one to cut. But I had sent him four songs, and one of them being Before the Next Teardrop Falls, and he liked that one a lot. And he was really excited after that.
How did it come about? Like, what was the impetus of the whole thing in the first
place? Well, Amazon was going to start a new series called the Produced by Playlist, and they were foolishly going to let me be the first one. And so I got to basically pick out artists I'd like to produce. So we did one with John Prine. We did one with Margot. We did one with William Bell, and then Aaron Ray. And I had actually had an idea for a couple other artists. I never thought Al Green would actually say yes. So I was focusing on some other artists, and they couldn't do it because of scheduling. And so I said, man, Chris Graham, the awesome Chris Graham at Amazon, I said, let's, you know, I've been to his church. He preaches. He still performs sometimes. I wonder if Al Green would do it. And my mutual, our friend Bruce Watson, is one of the owners of Fat Possum, who handles his back catalog. So we reached out to Al at his church. And
so you didn't know him before this?
No. He's kind of a mysterious, reclusive man.
Right.
I thought it would really depend on the song, you know? And so I had sent a couple songs, and then this Before the Next Teardrop Falls, I was like, this is the one. I was trying to think about where he is now in his career, in his life. He's obviously passionate about, you know, his church and, mm-hmm. you know, what kind of message would he want to sing if it was secular, or would he prefer a gospel song? So I was trying to weigh all those things without knowing him. And, I sent the Before the Next Teardrop Falls last, but when I heard that one, I thought, this is, if he's going to say yes, this is the one. And he called me out of the blue.
Wow.
I remember where I was, and I picked it up, and it was Al Green. It was incredible. I probably stuttered through the whole thing, you know.
yeah.
But he said he liked the Before the Next Teardrop Falls song. So then we picked a date, and he came to the studio right at the time he said he would, which is unbelievable. And we cut it in about an hour and a half, and it was
all live.
Yeah, all live. It was the greatest day of my life. He went back and overdubbed some vocals, like, you know, he likes to harmonize and double with himself. Yep. So we did some of that. And then the next day, I did the strings and the horns all in a day.
Okay, I wondered about
and
that.
And the background vocals, mixed it real fast, and it was just like, that's another thing. It's so surreal.
On a song like that, it really sounds like, in a way, you were going for, you know, like a high records kind of thing, like, it, you know, just to keep it super authentic, but without like being copying about it or anything. But can you just explain how you approach the aesthetics of that single? Because it's a good example of like capturing the essence of some of those sounds, like kind of a dry sort of almost distorted snare drum, and the strings are all kind of like panned to one side, horns are panned to one side. Are there some hallmarks that you really went for of the Memphis sound on that?
Well, with Al, you know, Al Green is one of the few people that before he even starts singing, you know, it's an Al Green song, you know, from the first 5 seconds, whether it's that snare drum or the horn or whatever, you know, it's an Al Green song. And I am a massive Al Green fan, and a big Willie Mitchell, his original producer's fan. And Charles Hodges, who played organ and all that stuff, he played on the song we did. I was going to get his brother Leroy, who played bass on all the original stuff, but he was out of town. They were such a unit and a thing together. And then Willie and Al came back later in the 2000s and did that I Can't Stop, and I forget the name of the other Blue Note record. And it was the same studio. It was the same band, same producer, same artist, but it was that updated sound. And it just, I felt like it was missing some of the, it was missing something. Nothing against those guys. It's a fabulous album. And I understand not doing what you've already done. But there is a thing to Al. He's kind of like, I was telling another friend of mine, he's like apple pie. Like, you know what it looks like, you know what it tastes like. You don't want to see apple pie with, like, you know, a bunch of kale on top, you know? Like, at some point, you just want apple pie to be apple pie. And when we had this song, I knew I wanted to work up the arrangement to be more indicative of, like, I wanted to be that thing where in 5 seconds, you know that this is Al. Oh my God, is this Al Green? Before
it totally
he starts singing.
Yeah.
And I wanted to, I think part of that, so when I knew that when he started singing too, and it was like, oh my God, he still sounds like he did in 1971.
He sounds amazing still, doesn't
he? Yeah, he really does. And on a quick side note, when he got there, we were so excited and nervous. We were playing the song way too fast, and he started singing. And if you know that song, I'm a Ram.
Yeah.
I always thought that was just Willie Mitchell kind of distorting his vocal or whatever to tape. That's Al manipulating his own voice, kind of like how Elvis does on Jailhouse Rock. Yeah, he like, whatever he does it in his throat.
It's so distorted sounding.
Yeah, I'm sure Willie did distort it too, but Al's doing that with his voice because we were playing it fast, so he came in there, and you can kind of hear him do it on the end, like the, I'll be there. He like puts the crunchiness in his own vocal.
Wow.
And I was like, hey guys, I think we need to slow it down and pretty it up, you know? So then the next take, which in being the master take, we slowed it down. That's when he started doing the, if you ever, you know, like the Tinder thing. Yeah. And that's when we were all like, whoa, we started just all giggling. But yeah, I wanted it to, I felt like if it sounded too clean or too modern, it would be weird. And that's a classic song feeling too. So you have to treat the song, it's not just the artist, but you know, what does the song want to thing? So it was really, I don't know. I've talking about this is I've spent more time thinking about trying to answer your question than I did when we tracked, you know, when we tracked it, you just got in there and just go.
Do you think he appreciated the details that you were bringing to it to kind of give it that authentic sound?
He was super enthusiastic. He definitely liked that it was a country song. He really like wanted to do, because he did a lot of great country covers back in the day. So he was more interested in the country side of it than he was, I think, the, you know, driving high records part of it, you know. But yeah, he was so enthusiastic and just like smiling the whole time. It was amazing. To have him there. But yeah, all I wanted to do is for Al to sound amazing and for, you know, it was Al Green before he came on the.
And then you brought the horns and the strings in later. Do you arrange those or is that you bring in a guy to do that or how does
Well,
that work?
The great thing about Memphis is ever since the day we do like kind of head arrangements. So the strings I gave to Lester Snell. Lester Snell has been a longtime Stax and high record string arranger. He was the Isaac Hayes' band leader and musical director back in the heyday. And he's just one of the most amazing, brilliant musical minds. So he had the night we finished the Al Green thing, I would have done it all the same day, but I wasn't sure if Al would show up late or not at all or anything. So I staggered him. But Lester came with the night we cut it and we like went over an arrangement together, and he does all the hard work. And then same thing, Mark Franklin of the Memphis Horn guys that I use, he came up and kind of heard it, and then they came the next day, and we basically, I don't think we tweaked the strings too much on the floor, but the horns, we came up with all the horns basically on the floor live.
Okay.
Like they would come and listen to it once twice, come with parts, and we'd do it. And same thing with the girls. So the girls, let's see, Susan and Reba sang the same day we did the horns.
So how big is the string section on that? Is it just
that
like
is just
six?
A quartet.
It's a quartet, yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to, you know, that Willie stuff is like never big string. And I was surprised at how we got the quartet to almost sound like high records strings too. I mean, Lester did the arrangement, but.
Give me a tip on that. How did you, like, how do you record
Willie recorded everything through an Ampex 351. It was an 8-track. He had him and Les Paul and like one other person had the rare Ampex 8-track tube machines. And then he would mix down to a 2-track Ampex. And he loved RCA 77s. So part of it was using RCA. I didn't use RCA on the mics. On the Al Green strings, we had just done William Bell's session before that, and I thought I'd come up with my best string miking for the quartet, and then I had an idea to swap two mics, and that's what I did on the Al Green thing. And that's, I think, the best string sound I've gotten was swapping those two mics. But I end up at the end running it all down, you know, through the Ampex 351, and it adds this level of crust to it, I think.
And you individually mic the four players, or do you just sort of treat it as one?
What I did on that one was I had the violin share one microphone. I don't like to individually mic the violins, and it's, you know, way up high. And then I had a mic on the viol and the cello And then I had a big room mic, a ribbon room mic, and I mostly use the room as the sound. And if there's individual pizzicato or bowing parts on one, I bring up. But the thing is, I quickly mix all those strings down to mono. I don't want to ever have to like rebalance. I just mix them in mono, be done with it, and then go from there. And then it's got
and a is lot that of, a, was that a thing with high to put horns on one side and strings on the other? Was that their
Willie
thing?
If you listen to those records, they all I love hard panning already.
Yeah.
But yeah, Willie would hard pan his records. The horns are always to the right, so always even like I this guy's record I mixed last week, his horns are all to the right. But I've always been a hard panner already. Willie, ever since I made records, the horns go to the right for Willie Mitchell.
Oh, that's cool, man. Respect. I love it.
Unless the artist doesn't like it, then I'll move them.
Yeah. But. Well, thank you, man. Thanks for talking to me today. It's been great.
Well, thanks for having me.
Best of luck with getting the studio up and running. It sounds exciting.
Yeah, come down to Memphis sometime and see it.
I love what you do and hope to meet you one of these days.
That would be awesome. Thank you, Steve.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
All right,
take care, man.
Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. That was my conversation with Matt Ross Spang. Hope you enjoyed it. I had a ball doing it. And we will see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then. Thanks for listening, everybody. The Music Makers and Soul Shakers podcast was recorded in Nashville, Tennessee at the Hen House Studio. Don't forget to follow us on social media and please subscribe to the show at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify Podcasts. And you can find us online at makersandshakerspodcast.com. As always, thanks to Jeremy Holmes in Vancouver for help with research. And we'll see you next month for another chilling episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. See you then.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.